I'm sure we won't get through all of it, but we'll do what we can. And what we don't, I'm going to give you a copy of the. I'm going to give you a copy of an article, and we're actually going to work off of the article a little bit. It was published in a book. It sold, I don't know, 12 or 13 copies, and it was the 36th anniversary of the live grooming in a Temple Beth Am in Los Angeles. You can see a list of the chapters, and although this was not what I wrote about was the founding of the Neshama Minyan, which were you there for literally that night?
I don't think I was there then, but I think the first time, like before I spent the summer learning with you, you invited me for a shopping.
Okay, all right, so I'm going to tell you, you'll be there tomorrow. So it's still going, and I'll tell you a little bit about the history of it, but I don't want to spend too much time on that. I want to talk about could have been in the ideas that work session, but I want to talk a little bit about how you do this, and just think together with you about davening as an activity, not liturgy, but davening as an activity and space as we use the room. This is not how this room was set up. Let me tell you a little bit about the history first. So this was in Los Angeles, in the Pico Robertson neighborhood. It's a part of Los Angeles where a lot of Ziegler students at the Ziegler Rabbinical School and HUC and Jewish professionals. It's a walking neighborhood. At the time, there was a regular Friday night service at Beth Am. It was a traditional minyan. I don't think at that point that women were counted. And the Friday night experience lasted 20 to 25 minutes. And it was essentially, I'm being a little bit critical, but I don't want to be totally critical of it. It was just running through the service. It was just, there were people who needed to say Kaddish. They were very faithful. They came every Friday night. But if you wanted some sort of different experience, there wasn't one in the Pico Robertson neighborhood. And welcome. Feel free. The rooms got switched.
Okay. So is this Karlbach?
Yes. This is Karlbach. Yeah. So come on in here, take an article. There wasn't anything. What there was, Gordon Bennett Cunin at the time, who's a colleague of ours in Los Angeles, had a minion that would meet in his home periodically. And the strengths of meeting in a home is that it's a very intimate space, and the weaknesses are that some people just don't feel comfortable walking into someone else's home unless they've been personally invited. And so as a newcomer to the neighborhood, it was a little bit intimidating to go. I was interning, so I went to Jerusalem for the year from 1999 to 2000 as part of my the rabbinical school program, had some wonderful davening experiences, and I came back and I was interning at Beth Am with Joel Rembaum, and wanted to start a Friday night Karlbach. What I would say, Karlbach Minyan, right? The truth is that I was building as much off of my experiences at Yakar with Rabbi Mickey Rosen, Zichrono Levracha, as I was off of Karlbach, but obviously there's a lot of overlap. So I want to walk through just sort of some of the decisions that we tried to tackle in thinking about how do you begin something like this. Before I sort of ramble on for a while, I want to actually hear from you two things. Number one, what if you had to craft your ideal Friday night service, what would it be like? Suppose you inherited, because I inherited nothing. I mean, generally, I don't want to say nothing. I wasn't, by the way, we didn't want to change the traditional service. They continued to do it. They thought it was kind of funny because they would peek in and we would be all singing and stuff. But their service continued to run, but we created this essentially from nothing. So if you had, you know, a Friday night experience, and I'm talking about for your community, but also for yourself, right? Because if you create something, then you end up as a rabbi having to attend it, right? So you should like it, right? Somebody once said that, you know, if as a rabbi you don't like the synagogue that you daven in, right, like after 5 or 10 years, like you really need to change it, right? Because you're going to be there, God willing, for a long time. So for Friday nights, if you could create your ideal service, right, what would you do?
No longer than an hour.
Okay, no longer than an hour. Why?
Because it's Friday night and I've lived through a very long week and the last thing I want to do is be in shul for an hour and a half to 2 hours.
Okay, so very important, right, to think about, number one, just how long does this last, right? Because it's the end of the week. You haven't had Friday night to sleep, right? So, you know, Shabbat morning we may, although I still think Shabbat morning tends to be too long, but you have more patience for it because you have a chance to relax. Here, right, you've just finished long weeks and you're tired, right? So it can't be something too long, right? By the way, there are traditional terms for all of this. Tircha d'tzibura, right, is very important. You have to have a sense of what is the capacity of this community, right, for moments. And one of the things that I want to just remind all of us of is that, you know, in the Jewish tradition, there are peak moments and non-peak moments within the liturgical service. Right, so the Kedusha has very strict rules about you don't move your feet, you don't get interrupted for anybody, right? And everybody stays still. But you only have those for the Kedusha, and if you're, you know, for the private Amidah, right? For the other parts of the service, you can get up, you can walk around, right? There's certain responses that you can and you can't make. But we sort of build these concentric circles, right, that tell us we can focus this intensely for a certain amount of time and less intensely for greater and greater amounts of time. What else would the ideal service look like?
Singing.
Say more about that. Who is singing? What type of singing?
I mean,
and why
singing? I was one of those lucky guys who got to create my service. So, and I've actually been fortunate to do it with a men's choir. We are totally egalitarian shul, but I wanted to do something with men, and so we kind of gather around in the we have the amud is in the middle,
mm-hmm.
and so everybody gathers around that. And if there's one thing that we've been successful with is we only sing synagogue and congregant inspired melodies.
Oh, so the congregants actually wrote the melodies?
No, I don't mean it that way, but they're melodies that everyone can sing. The choir is singing for the congregation.
Okay.
At the same time, I'm fighting that natural tension that those guys have a nice voice, let's listen to them.
Okay, so there's this balance between... And a lot of people are trying to do this. We're exploring this in my own congregation about having a davening team, right? You know, maybe a choir. I probably would even stay within the language of a choir.
Right.
With the idea being that there is a critical mass, right? There's a critical mass of voices that you need to hear in order to enable other people to sing, right? But on the other hand, you don't want it to be a performance, right? Because I heard you say, we're using these melodies specifically so that everybody can sing, right? So there is... now, by the way, this is different, right? Other people... And I'm not convinced, actually, that this works everywhere. I will tell you, I've been very humbled. I intern at Sinai Temple with David Wolpe, and I came out of this experience with Temple Beth Am and everybody singing together. And I went to Sinai Temple, and they had a wonderful cantor with an operatic voice, not easy to sing with, okay? But they had an organ, and they had a choir, and there are regularly 900 or 1,000 people there on Shabbat morning, right? And it was humbling because I needed to say to myself, you know what? Some people want to listen, right? Some people want to listen. And I don't want to say be performed for, right, because I think that trivializes it, but some people want to be inspired by what happens up there. So it's not for everybody,
correct?
Right? But I think you can sort of articulate, no, you know, on Friday night we actually want everybody to participate. We're going to choose melodies that are familiar and that people can sing along with. What else about the experience? What happens on Friday night? What do you want to happen on Friday night?
Feel like a community. Feel like people I want to see. You know, looking for... My mom goes every Friday night, and not because she enjoys the chazanut, She goes because she's got her back row benchers, which is what they call themselves. And it's the group of women that she sits with in the back row, and that's when they catch up with each other, and they go, and then they have dinner together, and that's her mishpacha.
Okay.
Shul mishpacha. You want there to be people you want to see.
So I'm going to talk about this a little bit later on, but Ron Shulman and Lawrence Hoffman have written that every worship experience should have three things. Right? A moment of transcendence, or possible transcendence. It's hard, right? I mean, Elliot Dorf will tell you, that davening is like baseball, right? If you get a home run every 20 times at bat, you're in the Hall of Fame. If you get a hit every, three times at bat, then you're in the Hall of Fame, right? So, but there should be at least the possibility of transcendence. There needs to be silence, right? And I'm going to push that a little bit further than just the silent Amidah, but there needs to be silence. And there needs to be community. There needs to be a moment of community, right? And those three things, right, need to be present in each service, right? That we craft that take place. What else do you want to happen on Friday night? Be more specific. What does the room look like? Ma'od.
I think in order to see and be part of the. To be part of the community, it's about seeing the other people and not the back of everyone's heads.
Okay.
Some sort of, maybe a more intimate space.
So let me ask a question, right? Alicia said it's about seeing other people's faces, and does everybody agree with that?
There's something nice about it.
Think there's something nice about it?
I think there's something nice about it. I think it's more the intimacy of a packed room.
Okay.
People feeling that connection with one another, a little bit crowded, so that they're sort of fighting over their personal space, because when they sort of invade each other's personal space, because there's so many people in the room, there's a warmth that's created.
So I'm going to tell you, I am a huge believer in the importance of, it is the rabbi's job, welcome, nice to have you. It is the rabbi's job, it is the cantor's job, that somebody needs to take responsibility for the space. Okay? And we need to pay attention to it, because it has a huge impact on what happens. And oftentimes those decisions are made by the janitorial staff, by your maintenance staff, who have either no instructions, and so they set something up that they think is right. And so I want to just show this to you, okay? I took a picture of this room before we started, okay? Before I got here, okay? And I want you to see how it was set up. Those tables, those tables were like that, and it was facing this way, and then there was a table over there, and I did what I typically do. If I'm using a room that isn't set up, is I'll go and sort of spend a lot of time, like personally looking at the chairs, right, and thinking about how it's set up. There are two schools of, there are at least two schools of thought about this, about how we do this. One of them is the U, okay, and that is when we were starting the Neshama Minyan, that was the choice that I made and that we made in terms of the room setup. It was something like this. This is a little bit crowded because you have these tables, and I would get rid of the tables, and I would get rid of the water, and there's some extraneous stuff. But generally, when I'm leading the Kabbalat Shabbat service, I'm not standing up in front of people. Okay, if I'm standing up like this, what am I communicating to you as the prayer leader? What?
You're other.
Okay, I'm other. Why?
You're not sitting like the rest of us.
Because I'm not sitting like the rest of you.
We have to follow you.
And what am I asking you to do? To look at me. Okay. Why? Because I'm here. Okay? What else am I communicating?
Your boss.
That I'm the boss. Why am I the boss?
Frontal.
Because I'm facing you, right? And you're sitting, and I'm standing. I'm standing, you're sitting. I'm facing you, and your job is to listen to me. Okay? If I'm sitting here, what am I communicating?
You're part of us.
That I'm part of us. What else?
Can I challenge that?
Yeah, please.
I really ask that. in the humblest way.
Please.
Aren't you making tremendous assumptions when you say that? I mean, I know that like that's sort of the... What you've just said is sort of our standard way of viewing, I guess, the traditional Jewish world. And I have to believe, whereas I certainly totally understand what you just described, but aren't there some very traditional congregations where there's a sense of unity and the person who's standing up doesn't see him or herself that way, and the congregants don't as well? I mean, it seems like we're going from one extreme to the next. I struggle with that sometimes.
Let me be really clear. When I asked, what does this communicate, right? I didn't have the answers. I don't have the answers for your community, right? I was asking the group of people in this room, and those were the answers, okay? What I commend to you is to try and figure out a way to have the conversation with your community, right? In other words, you may go to your community and you may say, you know, what does this convey to you? And they may give you different answers, right? But the answers are what, and I didn't say anything except stand up. And I asked you, what am I communicating by standing up? But I think as prayer leaders, we need to be aware, right, that how we, where we position ourselves, right, how we stand or sit, are not neutral. It's not neutral,
correct?
And we just, we need to ask the questions, right? How are people hearing this, right? So I'm not telling you that that what was said here is true elsewhere. But I do think that, and by the way, I'm not even telling you to do this. When I give it to Bar Torah, I'm not sitting here, right? I did make the decision, by the way, to teach from here, because to me, these sessions are not useful if they're frontal or if it's sort of this model of education that I'm going to stand here and tell you everything for that, sure. I know, and then you're just, you know, going to walk away happier. Like that. So
I appreciate that.
Right?
Thank you.
But I think, again, it's not neutral, and we need to be intentional about it.
For sure.
So the you, you know, I'll tell you a few things about the you. First of all, I mean, if I had more space, the other thing which this does is it creates an empty space in the middle, right? Let me say, I'm telling you sort of what's in my mind and my experience of it, but it creates an empty space in the middle that says we need to fill this space, right? You know, as opposed to I'm filling this space, right, because I'm the leader, right? This says there's actually, there's no leader here, and so we all need to sort of do this together. I want to follow the time here. There are decisions to make. So I made a decision here to have space, okay, and to have a row in the middle, right? So if there's a row in the middle, right, when you come in, then this seat is really accessible, these are really accessible, I can easily get up here, and you actually have an easy way out. People like exits, right?
This was my spot right here by the door.
This was your, right, people, some people are exit people.
That was my spot.
By the way, other people are side people, okay? And I'll tell you, so here's the decision about the row up here, right? If you have a row, if at the end of Lechadodi you want to dance, okay? Some people want to dance. I haven't danced in a while, but, you know, some people, we wanted to dance, okay? You need to think, where are people going to dance, right? Otherwise, there's going to be a traffic jam, right? And so here, you could actually, right? You could actually, like, go around the room, and you have, like, this place to spiral and dance, and you can move in and out. And if I don't have that, right, then, and if this is over here, right, and this is filled, then it's closed, and so there's no real way to go. It also, by the way, makes these chairs very inaccessible, right, because I have to walk through all those people. On the other hand, some people are wall people, right? I really enjoy, right, the experience of davening next to a wall, right? There's things in the Gemara about about davening next to a wall, right? And the experience that people have at the Kotel, right? Because sometimes people want to feel, they want to feel a sense of safety, okay? The other school of thought is Rose, right? That all face forward, right? And here, I will say that I think that there's a tremendous strength. So in my own congregation, we actually rearranged pews. We have these big pews, but we figured out a way to rearrange them for a while until we can get more flexible chairs. But we rearranged the pews into a U. And something very deep that I heard from people is, I don't like davening on a regular basis in a U because I don't want people to look at me, right? I want to face forward, and when I'm facing forward, I feel this unity with everybody. There's a certain anonymity which I have, as it allows me to have kavanah, right? The only thing, and here I will be a little bit. So again, just good to be aware, right, that people have these different reactions. I'm not saying you or not you. I'm just saying there are differences. There are real differences in terms of the experience of prayer that people have based on whether or not is somebody looking, are people looking at each other or are people facing forward. Abraham Joshua Heschel, if I can commend to you one article, it's in a book called The Insecurity of Freedom. The essay is called The Vocation of the Cantor. It's an extraordinarily important article about tefillah. And one thing which he says, and it, again, it's called The Vocation of the Cantor. I think The Insecurity of Freedom is out of print, but you know, you can find it somewhere. If you want, I'll PDF and send it to you. But he says the cantor essentially should not face the kahal. And I will say, I can't daven facing the community. So in our community, we have a bima up front, and there's an aisle in the middle, and it's very awkward. But we have these movable shtenders, and from my very first Shabbat, when I was asked to daven, I took the shtender, I went into the middle of the community, I went like right here, right? I mean, it's a little bigger aisle, and I faced along with everybody else, and I plopped myself right in the middle. Okay, because it's not a performance, and facing someone. Now the issues are people need to be able to hear you, right? But if you want to communicate to people, it's not a performance. Please pray with me. Then you go and you're with people, and this architecture of I'm up high, I'm facing you, and I'm facing in this direction, right? It's just very difficult to overcome. Right, the idea that the purpose is that you listen to me. Okay, that was Heschel's thing. Again, 900 or 1,000 people there on Shabbos morning at Sinai Temple with something very frontal. So I'm not saying it's right. You know, that it's the answer. I'm just saying that there's a message that's communicated. One more thing, Aaron, you said yesterday. You said there's an intimacy and there's a feeling in the room. Yeah. That was what was. How many of you were there last night at the end of Ma'arif? Okay, so it was an amazing experience, and part of why it was so amazing is that the room was crowded. It was small. Okay, so part of what you'll read about in the article is that when we were picking rooms in Temple Beth Am, it's a 1,000 family synagogue with a main sanctuary that seats 600 or 1,000 people. There's a library minion that seats a room chapel that seats 300 people. There's even a smaller sanctuary chapel upstairs that seats 120 people. We chose a room basically like this, right? And we did so bichavana, on purpose, right? Because I wanted to crowd people in, right? I don't want people to be able to come and sit 40, feet away, which is where people will sit, right? So we sort of figured out, you were very interesting, right? You sat in the first row. If we were davening, a lot of people won't sit here, right? It's just too close. They need to sit. So I'm going to put the second row, right, sort of as close as I can get them, right? We also put out 40 chairs, right? And we had another 20 in the corner, we ended up meeting him that night. We, you know, did good publicity, but it was actually exciting, right, to take out more chairs and to fill them in. But if only 30 people had shown up that night, it's a very different feeling when there are 30 people in a space for 100 versus 30 people in a space for 40, right? 30 people in a space for 40 feels full, right? So all of that is just to say, to be aware of architecture. And to me, the more flexibility that you have, I'll tell you one other story. I started this minion at Sinai Temple. There was no small space. Their smallest space was 225 people. So what we did is I worked with the maintenance staff and we got room dividers. Okay, and we were in the back corner of this chapel. We had room dividers, and we created small space, right? And I had them put out these chairs, and we even had like those tables, and we had, you know, room for people to drum and stuff like that. But so part of it about space. I want to talk for most of the rest of the time about timing and davening, but
120 seconds.
Yeah,
you compared the U to the rose, but you didn't talk about the advantage of a U over a circle, which is what I would have thought you would go to initially.
Well, let me ask you: what do you think the advantages and disadvantages of a circle are?
In a circle, there's nowhere you can sit for anonymity.
Okay, so you're totally exposed, right?
There's also no way out.
And there's no way out, right? Where do you put the aisle, right? It has to be there needs to be a break somewhere. And where, how do you
and
get
somebody's
in?
Somebody's always behind the speaker.
Right.
You know, there's the focal point is very undefined to a certain extent.
Right.
And if you're the speaker, the doctor, the focal point, you end up in the center and you end up just making circles.
Right.
Right, unless you sit, and then it can be very disorienting for people. But and the other thing is, you know, we have this task of bringing people in. In other words, pushing people to a little bit beyond vulnerability, right, or to be more vulnerable than they're ready, but also giving them a safe space. And the circle, you know, as was said, is you're just exposed. And I think that part of our task, I think we need to be to make a way for people to be protected and exposed at the same time. Right? Again, I'm not arguing for or against anything. I think it's good to think about, right? And just the next time that you're in a space, ask yourself, you know, yeah.
Just one quick comment. We just built a sanctuary 4 years ago, and to determine what the seating, we wound up going, the hardest decision the whole thing was fixed seating or not. But we were in a very small place, and we wound up for two of my holidays, and two of my girls' bat mitzvahs, we sat in a Catholic church that was 100% in the round. It was a gorgeous sanctuary. And our congregation fell in love with it because they like to see each other's faces. It's really interesting, your comment. And they just fell in love with that. And I think part of it was so different. You know, people are used to sitting in the straight lines. And they really appreciated the sense of community by seeing faces. And we're sort of like three quarters. We're close to you now, but with a beam in the front. But we have two focal points, so we have a center in center of the on the floor. The omelet is on the floor, so we kind of it's really worked remarkably well, and that's how we wound up addressing that.
I'll throw one other thing out there, which is we've talked a lot about chairs, but one of the most beautiful davening spaces. Well, I'll tell you two examples, and then I want to move us forward. Because I want to do a singing for a minute or more, and then talk about timing in terms of davening. But two examples. One, if you've been to Yakar on Friday night in downstairs, if you look in the Shulchan Aruch, you'll see that the davening in a Beit Midrash is actually preferable to davening in a Beit Knesset. okay, according to halakha, right? So they use their Beit Midrash, and what they do, they actually have sort of lots of rows, but there are a few tables, right, in the corners. And it's very nice, these people, and they're, everybody's facing this direction, but at the front, there are these people who are sitting around a table, and some of those people, if you're on, like, this side of the table, you're looking out at everybody else. But it's so crowded, like, you're not looking at anybody, you're just sitting at a table, and those people will drum. Right? Now, it's okay because it's a table, not a drum, right? But they'll beat on the tables. And one of the questions you have to ask yourself is if you want people, you know, you heard it last night, right? There were people started to, but you have to give people something to hit, right? You can use a sidur, you know, but people feel a little bit funny about that. If the pew is too big, right, then they're like reaching forward like this. But I think it's an interesting thing to think about. You know, what do you, does it have to be all chairs, you know, with nothing in front of you, right? With nothing in front of you, or is there a way to incorporate other other things? And again, if you have a flexible space, then, you know, you work with your maintenance staff, you buy, you know, a little extra piece of furniture. You'll see it here. I went through some other things. We thought about lighting. If it's too dark, then, and it's a nighttime service, people will be sleepy. And you know, especially if you sing a slow nigun. So there is like a certain amount of lighting that you have to think about. And also sidurim and transliterations. We have to think about if you're going to sing. So the Karlbach Minyan that we started was essentially all Hebrew. I mean, there were no English readings or anything like that. But we wanted it to be welcoming. We were setting it up to be welcoming, and so we had out there. I still haven't found the ideal Friday night sidur. I don't know if anybody's on the Lev Shalim, you know, committee, but there's. You know, if there are these sidurim that are Hebrew, that are transliteration, that are English, that are sort of all set up together, we had booklets with a full transliteration. And what we did is we didn't just put Psalm 95, we put the page number in Sim Shalom next to the, you know, whatever prayer it was in the transliteration booklet. So somebody, if they heard me, I wasn't announcing three different page numbers. If somebody heard me say 262, then they could look in their transliteration booklet and follow, right, and see that. So,
Ben, can we talk just a moment about sidurim and just what other? I know Eight Ratzonim, I know Top has a writing sidur. Are there other publishing houses that have sidurim?
I'm going to say let's actually just look online and okay. You know,
there's a company in Detroit called Singlish, yeah. And what he does is so that's my synagogue did that. They created their own class when I grew up, and it's got so it's Hebrew transliteration in English, but the English is written so you can sing it to the traditional Friday night melody, so it fits the meter of the Hebrew too.
Okay.
Makes it easier to sing in English. You don't have to change your melody to fit in words.
And the other thing, when you have a transliteration, you have to put the box in.
Right.
Because if you're going to pick up at the box, if there are things where you're going to pick up, you got to show people where you're picking up. So a couple of things about timing, just in terms of length. We announced an end time. Okay. And what I want to say is when you're doing a Karlbach Minyan, you have to let people know that you're going to end it on time, and then you have to end on time, okay? Part of what that does is it allows people to go on with a melody. It will allow you to go on with a melody and for people to be fully engaged in it because they're not worried that it means that their dinner is going to get cold, right? So do you understand what I mean? You have to create a vessel, and you have to say, so I remember we said we're going to start at 4:45 with Mincha. We'll do, you know, Kabbalat Shabbat from 5. I think Kabbalat Shabbat and Maariv 5 to 6:15. That was even a little long, right? At my shul now, we do every Friday night at 6 o'clock. We don't actually have services every Friday night, but anytime we do, we have it at 6 o'clock, and it's 6 to 7. Okay, and I basically tell people, give yourselves over to me and to the service for an hour, right? And we're going to be an hour, so you can go. You can know that you're going to go and have dinner, And what that does is if I want to push a nigun, right, for 5 minutes or even 10 minutes instead of 2 minutes, people are okay because they know I'm going to pick it up on the other end. Okay? And what I want to say, I'm going to close the door for this just so we can... So
Aria Cohen is a teacher at AJU, a teacher at Talmud, and he comes from a Hasidic family, and he says, conservative synagogues sing a nigun for 2 minutes and 37 seconds. Okay? And what he means by that is that we have a certain amount of time that we sing a nigun, and then we're done. Right, so like if you know El Adon Al Kol HaMasim, right, and then you go Ya Na 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 Na, and we all know how long that goes, right? Right, Da Na 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 Na, and then we continue Leila Shavah Mikol HaMasim, right? We just keep going. If somebody kept going with that for 5 minutes, like we don't do that. Right? And the truth is that I'm not saying that we have to become like Haredim. Okay, I don't need to become like the Haredim. But the Nigun, right, the Hasidic Nigun comes from a place, right? And there was a beautiful project done, I can't remember, but it was a musicology project that was, and you can get 3 CDs of, they were recorded on Motzei Shabbat of Hasidic communities singing Nigunim. And some of them are 15 or 20 or 25 minutes long, and the nigun sort of has it's an organism, it's a life. It breathes. It inhales and it exhales. It grows and expands and contracts. And I think, you know, again, I don't think that every service has to be a Carlebach service, but I would just say, in our toolbox, right, we want to have the capacity to push people a little bit beyond their comfort zone, and to sing for a little bit longer. Now, there's 16 minutes left I want to sing for a few minutes, okay? And just see if we can get a sense of how this feels, okay? I recommend you close your eyes, and I promise we'll finish on time. So, and I don't know how long we're going to sing, but let's just sort of see where it goes, okay? And I hope this... It's a relatively easy nigun and probably will be familiar to many of us. And if not, just sing, okay? It's okay.
Na 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 na
So, what was happening when we were doing that? What were you doing?
It was good for the first 2 minutes and 37 seconds.
It was good for the first 2 minutes, and then?
That was fine.
Okay. Did it change at certain points? What were you thinking? Yeah.
At first, I got very tense. I mean, I was holding my husband's hand, but I wanted to do that. And I sort of felt my body tense, and then whenever the melody, it sort of like opens a gate, and I kind of was able to go forward. And then I noticed, as soon as I started paying attention, like my mind started to wander again, and that would get tight. And I was aware of that, so I was able to kind of like relax my body and just feel the tranquility and the peace, and I just felt like energy, my cells relaxing.
What was happening with the group? How did we figure out when to stop?
I was listening to you. I was like the little kid in the choir who was afraid that the choir master was going to stop the song, and I was going to be the one still singing, the only one left in the stand still singing while everyone else had stopped.
Was there a moment... So that nigun, right, had a beginning and an end, right? And by which I mean, and then it repeats, right? And the overall nigun had a beginning and an end. And the end point comes at the end of the each individual nigun, right? And so, do you know what I mean, right? Each time, is a question that you as the person leading the davening need to answer. Are we continuing or are we not? Right? And so each time that I would pick up again, na 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 na, right, part of what I was doing is signaling we're starting, right, or we're not stopping, right? You weren't worried, right, in the middle of ya na na na, you weren't worried that I was going to like stop there, right? Because it had a beginning and an end, right? The idea of becoming tense and then relaxing only happens over the course of time. Your mind can only wander if it's going to go on for a while, right? And the first few times you're sort of saying to yourself, you're testing the waters, right? Like, am I swimming in this or am I not? What's happening, right? And so there is some, it was also softer. My breathing also got more regular. Like I knew where to inhale and I knew where to exhale. Not only in terms of leading, but just in terms of singing it. I wasn't, you know, there's sometimes when it'll be very ecstatic, right? Yeah, nine, 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 right? That's a very different nigun than what we did. Right? That was more sort of light and to me, there's a certain maturity, right, to a singing experience like that. What I want to do. And I invite all of you, again, I'm not telling you that that's what happened or that that's how to do it. I'm just saying, you know, this is it's something to think about. And that we as people leading prayer or our cantors, you know, if our cantors can do stuff like this, I wish the seminary would create a cantorial school that focused on this sort of thing. We focus on notes and scales, but not the silence between the notes, which is where the music is. And I have a whole rant about that, but... go ahead, and then while you speak, Steve, if I can ask you to open the article at page 187, okay, because that's what I want to spend the last 7 minutes
that's
on.
Fine, I'll ask you.
You'll ask me after? Okay.
That's fine.
So, to this point, there's a difference between saying, and I will actually talk about this with my bar and bat mitzvah kids. There's a difference between reading the liturgy and even singing the liturgy. And singing the melodies and leading davening, okay? And so I put this section together about leading davening, okay? First of all, and I'm just going to walk through a little bit of it. First of all, daven yourself. This may sound self-evident. I have talked to dozens of our colleagues who tell me that they went for years not praying in their own synagogues because they're focusing on the mechanics of the service. And I say this with no condemnation whatsoever. I'm not, you know, but what we do against our will is teaching a lesson. If we are rabbis who talk in the middle of davening, then we are teaching people, A, that you talk in the middle of davening, and B, that you're not davening. Why? Because you're not. You're talking. Right? And if only give yourself a silent amidah, okay? But we all know how to daven. We've felt it. We've been in these places. And we have to claim it for ourselves because if we don't, then our communities can't daven. They literally can't learn how to daven. Okay? So if we put our tallis over our head, and I know you can have your tallis over your head and be thinking of the phone book or be thinking about who won this course last night. So I can't judge whether or not we're davening. I'm just saying we need to daven. Okay? Otherwise, we're not leading davening. Right? Because you can't be motzi, you know, Yedei Chovotam, you know, you can't make other people yotze if you're not doing it yourself. That's what the halacha tells us. So that's my little plea, and I hope it's okay for me to say that, out loud.
But if you are working with a cantor or shliach, where you're, at least in my experience, there are times when I'm not davening because I'm all of this congregation. So I'm making sure I'm the captain of the ship and making sure it all is running.
So,
whereas the cantor or the seaboard is the one who's davening that.
So there's this. So I'm going to talk about page numbers. Okay. I urge you to have a conversation with your community on a regular basis, right? And to say, I need to do this dance between. If I call page numbers, then you know that I'm telling you the page number, but I'm not thinking about the words that are on the page. And yet, I want you to feel welcome, but I also know that I need to... And first of all, I'm a Jew, and I'm a rabbi, and I need to do this, because I love it. And I also need to exemplify that for you. And so I need to do this dance. And so, you know, we're going to put together... If you have a good, you know, card that has all the page numbers, that's great. If you call page numbers, I will actually do it from my seat, not from the microphone. And then it depends, like there are page numbers and page numbers. I don't tell everybody every page number. But I have a conversation with my community about that, right? I think you're absolutely right. By the way, during the Neshama Minyan, what I will do is to tell people what page we're on, I'll sing it. Okay? It's a little hokey, right? But I'll say something like, we continue on page 252, Lechune Manena, right? Because I'm like in that space, right? And I don't want to go, you know, page 252, right? Because again, that to me says, listen to me, I'm going to tell you, right? I'm trying to keep people there and I'm trying to keep myself there. Totally right. I just say share the problem, right? And I don't think and we know halakhically there's certain places where you don't call pages. So after the Kedusha is saying we continue privately with our Amidah, is like really tricky, right? Because if you're in that moment, then you're in that moment.
There's a balance,
right?
That has to be
right.
struck.
Exactly right.
And you know, community transcendent moment and silence, trying to strike that right balance.
That's right.
How to create and use all three of those elements.
Exactly
in
right.
The course of the service, and the folks that are coming are the folks who don't necessarily know Hebrew, don't necessarily know whether the Siddur is upside down or right side up, and want to feel included. So there's a balance.
But the thing that I throw out there, right, is about page numbers, is that, and I will tell this to people, like if I have a bar mitzvah and there are all these people there who have no idea what in the world is happening, I'll say to them, I'm not going to call every page number, but what I want you to know is that what's happening is not what's in the book. Mm-hmm. That there's a larger experience that I want to invite you to be a part of. Right? And so if you feel lost, it's okay, right? Knowing what page we're on may help you to feel slightly less lost, but the truth is that I don't want you to just follow the words on the Hebrew page, because that's the liturgy, it's not the prayers. Right? The prayer is the interaction between the two. We're going to run out of time, but let me just... So leading the davening by jumping in at the right moment, okay? What I want to say is, just like in the Nigun, right? You were listening for what's going to happen. Okay? There's certain moments when, if there's dead space, right? It's not like this amazing silence, it's just dead. Okay? So, understanding that that's part of our technique in terms of davening is when do we need to lead people and let them know, right? This is where we're going next. Okay? I talked about the silent middle, right? So Kabbalat Shabbat is sort of deadly because I'll say one thing about Kabbalat Shabbat. We should know that the words on the page were not what the Kabbalist had in mind. Okay? The Kabbalat Shabbat, it's six psalms. They were never intended to be, you know, those psalms were selected in somewhat randomly. Psalm 29 was the Kavanah, but they represented, and this is the Pshat, because it's a mystical service. Okay, the Pshat of Kabbalat Shabbat is the mysticism, and the mysticism was a process of what's called Tikkun HaNefesh. You can listen to Reuven Kimmelman on this. The first letters of each of the psalms add up to the word Nefesh in Hebrew. Okay, I won't walk you through it, but if you want this. And the idea was that by davening Kabbalat Shabbat, you were building the Nefesh Yeterah to take into Shabbos. Which means that whatever Psalm 95 says about God reigning the earth doesn't matter. It didn't matter for the Kabbalists. Okay? So, and what were you doing? It's literally, the first psalm is Sunday, the next psalm is Monday. They were periods of time to meditate about the week, to repair the week, and to go into the week, into Shabbat, with a repaired soul. That's what Kabbalat Shabbat was there for. That's why it was invented. So don't feel bad about if you go a little bit faster, right, between Lechuna Ranana and Arba'im Shana, Akut Bedur, right? It's to daven through it, right? It really is. It's a chant. It's not all prayer works this way, but the silent middle is again just that dead space. We're out of time, but let me just do one other thing. I have stuff here about page calling and teaching a new let me do teaching a new nigun. Or suppose the first night of Kabbalat Shabbat, nobody knew this liturgy. And I don't think these melodies are totally holy. But the Karlbach Nusach, you probably know, goes like this. You know that, right? So, two things about that. First of all, when I wanted to teach people, I told them, let's learn this together. I want you to repeat after me. Okay? So, let's do this now. Okay? So, please repeat after me. So a couple of things. First of all, it makes it very easy, right? Even if you don't read Hebrew, everybody can do chunkable sounds. Second of all, I held the notes. I didn't go like this. Right? That's weird, right? That's right. I'm holding the notes, right, so that you're hearing it, right? And so you're, and then I didn't wait for you to be done. Right? Right? Because you're building a momentum, right? It's not so chunky, right? It's not dead space, and you can hear the notes. By the way, also as you do it together, right? So let's do it once where we do this together. Please, so join with me, right? And I tell people, please join with me, please sing with me. So now let's do this. Did you notice where I took a breath? Right? Not between the first and the second, right? I kept going through that because you have to think about where you're going to, and this is all in music, right? If you read musical scores, but there's a momentum and you're inviting. I also didn't say lechu nerana. I got to because that's where people can easily sing with you, right? These are all. I don't. It's an art, not a science, but there is techne to it. There are techniques to it. I've tried to lay some of these out. What I was doing right there is the one that says start slow, sing the first few words of a prayer very slowly and deliberately, exaggerating. This allows and invites people to join with you because they'll know where you're going. Okay, but don't stay too slow because it'll feel lifeless and dead. Right? So there's this balance between. I offer all of these to you as tips, as helpful things. I don't think Karlbach is the answer to all of our life's prayers, but I do think that for me, Friday night is that break. It's the bridge between the rest of the week and Shabbat. When I was ordained, Reb Mimi Feigelson asked me, what's one thing that you can't live without? And for me, a Friday night davening experience, you know, I don't have it every week, as I said in my shul, and I can tell you more about that, but this is a very important experience to me. It's sort of where I come home to and find myself again, and I hope it can be for you too.
Thank you.